And Cobb has been focusing mainly on Latin American political economy and international migration. And she's published very widely in lots of different journals, including, for example, a special issue on international migration and home country politics, which is also part of what we're going to talk about today. Ish? No? You were going to talk about it. Changed. She's published a range of papers relating to the impact of remittances in different sort of realms. One is the impact of family remittances on vigilantism in Mexico. She's published on remittances and vote buying, and on remittances and protest in dictatorships. And today you're going to be talking about collective remittances and mobilization against crime in Mexico. Now, before I hand over to you, I just want to mention the next seminar of this series. It'll be given by Isabel Schutz, who's in social policy, and she'll be talking about civil society responses to the migration crisis in Greece. And that'll be on the 13th of November, same time, same place. Welcome, and I'm very much looking forward to your talk.
Thank you very much, Suzanne, for organizing this and for everyone for attending. I know that it's a very busy time for everyone. I want to apologize as well for the last minute change in the paper that I'm going to be presenting today. And in part, the reason is because the paper that I'm going to be presenting is part of it, of a series of three papers, all of them on the impact that crime has had on or is having on the relationship between immigrants abroad and their relatives back home, and how crime is impacting the sending of remittances and what recipients do with remittances in a context of violence. The only reason why I also decided to change the paper last minute is because I happen to have here one of my co-authors, Eduardo Ibarra Olivo, who is a brand new LSE doctor. So congratulations. I didn't have the chance to congratulate you in person, so this is fantastic that you're here. And Eduardo was fundamental in the crafting of this paper and all the empirical analysis, so he's here as well to answer questions too. All right, so I'm going to be talking a little bit about why and how to study the political consequences of remittances, which is my major agenda. What kind of political changes receiving remittances create or produce among those that receive them in their communities, in their states, in their households, and for individual political behavior, okay? And then I'm gonna be introducing the Mexican case, which is the country I know most about, and in part because I lived there for 9 years, and that's the country in which a lot of my research focuses. A little bit of the background. It is very, very common to start our presentations when we want to emphasize the importance of remittances and why studying them. And the fact is that we are talking about the second source of foreign income for many developing countries. It's becoming actually the first one for many developing countries, the major source of foreign income. The second one is FDI. And as you very well know, probably those of you that are familiar with the debates about migration and development, remittances have been the concern of economists for decades. They have been studying the economic consequences and the developmental consequences of remittances, okay? Consequences in consumption, poverty, public social investment, all sort of economic outcomes you can think of at the macro and the micro economic level. Being private transfers from people to people, from immigrants to their relatives, economists and political scientists as well have considered them pretty much away from governmental middlemen. So these are private transactions with which the state cannot miss as much as probably the states, many states want to, right? Because these are purely private transfers. But my whole research agenda and the research agenda of my colleagues working on the political consequences of remittances challenges precisely this assumption that remittances cannot be tackled by states, and also that remittances do not have political consequences. And this is precisely what I study. We political scientists defy the view that remittances are away from governmental middlemen, and take a stock. We start. Our departure point is precisely what economists have told us about the economic consequences of remittances, and from there we start to hypothesize about the political consequences, and we are debating whether remittances produce political engagement or political disengagement. And by political engagement, I mean, for instance, whether remittances increase voter turnout among recipients, whether they increase protest, as I will be commenting, whether they increase all the types of civic involvement, like joining associations, for instance. In general, what kind of impact remittances have for electoral behavior and non-electoral behavior, okay? And the discussion pretty much so far has been one of either remittances increase voter turnout or decrease voter turnout, increase protest or decrease protest, in those terms as rather exclusive sort of effects. And what we are saying in this paper, what we are arguing is that actually you can have both effects, like that remittances can have both an engagement and a disengagement effect, and very much depends on the largesse, the size of the inflows. This is pretty much work in progress, although two of the papers have already been published. But still, there are many loose threads in the argument, as you will see, so we are looking forward to having your feedback. Why studying Mexico, and why studying crime and remittances and contentious mobilization in Mexico? Well, Mexico is the epitome of a violent democracy, okay? And this paper is in particular part of a paper of a special issue on migrant involvement in violent democracies. What's a violent democracy? It's a polity in which competitive elections, civil freedoms, and inclusive participation have taken root, but the state does not control sub-state violence. I'm quoting my colleague Clarissa Pérez Armendáriz on this. In Mexico, organized crime has a very, very long history. It started in the 80s, increased, intensified by the mid-90s, but the whole thing went out of control under President Calderón's mandate between 2006 and 2012, and in part because of the strategy that the president decided to pursue, which was a strategy of fighting against organized crime, militarizing the conflict, which caused all sorts of problems. One of them was that sort of militarization of the fight against organized crime caused a multiplication of drug cartels as they started to fight against each other for the territory. So there are some very interesting research there showing that when one mayor, drug lord, was captured, the immediate result was new cartels fighting for the territory that this person had left empty, right? Some very impressive and very sad figures indeed, 70,000 killed, over 22,000 missing, and human rights violations of all sorts you can think of, forced disappearances and extrajudicial executions, the majority. And this happening against the background of a judicial system incapable of keeping up with the rate of crime and punishing criminal activity, in part because they themselves became the target of these organized groups. Okay, so it is in this context of prevailing impunity that some groups in those very heat areas decided to organize themselves, seeing that the state was incapable to provide protection to them, as well as the judicial system, okay? So what's Vigilant is? We are relying a lot in the work by our colleague, Brian Phillips, on the determinants of vigilantism in Mexico. Vigilantes, private citizens voluntarily seeking to control crime or other social infractions in a planned, premeditated way involving force or the threat of force. Okay. Some explanation as to why these organizations emerge. According to Brian Phillips, that has a lot to do with inequality in these communities. It's inequality and poverty, major factor breeding, feeding the emergence of these groups. Basically, this is a tool of the poor to protect themselves. Okay, the organizations in these sort of grassroots groups and this sort of mobilization. Okay, it's an instrument of the poor to protect themselves in context of high inequality, which they cannot have easy access to other means, of protection, be that private security or bribes to the judiciary system, so on and so forth. There is another type of vigilantism which is explicitly funded by patrons that pay someone to protect them, pay these groups, finance this group to protect them. And there are also explanations that rely on historical experiences shaping the formation of social networks. And it's very interesting, the work by Osorio and his co-authors, in which they focus on the Cristero War and how this Cristero War that happened in the 20s in Mexico, how the kind of social networks that were created there and the kind of guerrillas and movements that were created there predict very well the existence of vigilantism today. And we are interested in these social networks in general, because both in the study of what causes vigilantism and also nonviolent protest, which I'm going to be mentioning towards the end of the presentation, what we want to the idea that social networks are crucial for the emergence of this sort of mobilization is central to the argument. But it's mostly local networks. So what we are arguing here is that maybe we should be looking at international networks, these international networks that happen among the diaspora abroad and relatives and their families back home. We know, for instance, that in the case of Mexico, crime has been a cause of displacements. And there are estimates out there giving concrete numbers about Mexicans that have changed residency as a result of violence. This is ongoing research, and what I'm seeing lately is that it seems that displacements have been mostly internal displacements, more internal migration than international migration, but still, the number of displacements caused by this wave of crime has been very high. And our question is whether these transnational networks play a role, do they play a role in the emergence of vigilantes organizations in Mexico, okay? Why did we come up with this question? Well, because we found anecdotal evidence, journalistic evidence, suggesting that, well, that migrants seem to have played an important role in the emergence of these groups. So, for instance, frequently the leaders of these vigilante groups have had migrant backgrounds. And I like citing this person that said explicitly, this is a migrant, but said explicitly, each one helped their relatives the way they could. We sent money so that they could buy a gun. All right? And we started to find in different newspapers in Mexico and news reports about the war on drugs in Mexico, we started to find these sort of citations and these sort of comments, right? There is as well evidence that migrants have even returned explicitly to their communities to join these vigilante organizations, right? And so this is what we are asking in this paper. We are just basically trying to find out whether the remittances that migrants sent abroad finance these vigilante organizations or not. This is the very first time that it happens to me. Must have been the plane this morning. So, but what we are saying here is that this is not about an either-or kind of argument. It is not about whether remittances increase or decrease the probability of observing these groups, okay? But rather what we are saying is that it very much depends on the amount of remittances that are flowing in the municipalities, okay? Why is that? We are connecting this with some knowledge that we already have about the impact of remittances. Connecting it as well with other literatures, okay? So we know that in order to protest, we need two things. We need aggrieved people and people with money, with resources, okay? And we know something about what remittances do to grievances, right? And we are stipulating that they are fundamental in terms of providing extra resources to communities, to families and to communities to organize, okay? So on the one hand, we think that remittances increase protests, and we're following here resource models of political participation, right? But there are other mechanisms by which remittances may decrease protest. And why? Because remittances reduce economic grievances. Those families, those households that receive them, those communities that receive them, experience less poverty, right? Have more access to consumption, mostly. This is something that we know already through the research by economists. And what we know as well through research by political scientists is that those individuals that receive remittances make an assessment of their economic situation that is more optimistic than those that do not receive remittances, okay? And as a consequence, they tend to support whoever is in power more than non-remittance recipients, in part because they seem to be misattributing their economic betterment, no, the betterment of their economic conditions, they seem to be attributing it wrongly to whoever is in power, all right? In general, as I said before, in order to protest, you need to be aggrieved, and remittances reduce economic grievances, and not only economic grievances, they do reduce as well security grievances, as I'm going to be mentioning in a minute. And something that we know about remittances as well is that they have a substitution effect, by which I mean that those households that receive them, those individuals that receive them, and in the communities that receive these flows, there is a substitution between public provision and private provision of public and social goods, okay? So what we see in the case of Mexico, for instance, has been shown by Adida and Giro, that paper mentioned there, is that some public goods such as water, cleaning, such as pavimentation, electrification, they happen to be done by migrants or group of migrants, all right? And the political consequence of this is that remittance recipients become disengaged politically. They have much less incentives to demand accountability from their politicians, okay? So there are two mechanisms by which we could stipulate that the reception of remittances reduces protest. The first one is because of lower grievances, but the second one as well is because you can have access to certain public goods and I will mention that one of those public goods can be security, you can access them through the remittances you receive. Okay? Now, why do we say that it is not an either-or kind of effect? Because we say, we argue that, I'm going to be starting with the easy one to justify, that we are most likely to observe these economic grievances and substitution effect at high levels at high levels of remittances. Okay, think about, for instance, the substitution effect. The substitution effect in the case that we are talking about would say, for instance, in the same way that remittances allow private access to public and social goods, remittances may facilitate recipients' access to justice, to private security, and the funding funding the organization of others to provide protection. Now, just think about a typical remittance recipient household in Mexico. In order to devote money to private security, for instance, or in order to be able to receive remittances to the extent to be able to pay bribes to the judicial system, we're talking about sizable amounts. That's what we think. And I'm going to tell an anecdote, because I was throwing this at some point in one of my lectures here at the LSE, and someone came up with this possible substitution effect of private security instead of public security. And I was very surprised. But it happened to happen at the LSE, right? Our intuition here is that if there is a substitution effect in this realm of the public versus private provision of security, that would require people to receive a sizable amount of remittances, okay? And think about the reduction of economic and security grievances, okay? Lowering the propensity to mobilize against the state. Now, again, think about a typical household that are not, I want to emphasize, the poorest of the poorest in Mexico. But still, what we know is that most of the money that arrives is money that is devoted to finance current consumption, about 80%, okay? So again, it really requires a sizable amount of money to feel less aggrieved, economically speaking, right? And also to feel less grievances regarding security. There is a very recent research by Doyle and Lopez that is part of the special issue. And what they show is that people that receive remittances tend to have a better evaluation of how secure they are in their neighborhoods and how safe they feel their neighborhoods are. Why? It is not very clear. We don't know whether it is because precisely they can access better better security or the means of security, of securing themselves or not. But in any case, the idea here is that if remittances are to lower the probability of serving vigilante groups, that is going to happen when the households and the municipalities receive a lot of money, okay? If those are the mechanisms at play. On the other hand, what we know is that vigilantism is fed by poverty, on poverty, okay? So what we think is that it is precisely for those poor people for whom the reception of a little bit of money may be enough to motivate them to join with others to form these vigilante organizations. Precisely because they don't have any other option. What other option poor recipients of remittances living in these contexts may have if they receive a little bit amount of remittances? They are not going to be able, with a little bit of remittances, with a small amount of remittances, they are not going to be able to hire private security, right? And probably that little amount won't be enough to make them feel safer in high crime communities, all right? So the whole idea then is a simple one, is that we are going to observe that remittances produce both engagement and disengagement, but this engagement in the terms of a lower probability of observing vigilante organizations is going to happen at relatively high levels of remittance receipts. Am I making myself clear? Yeah, okay, good. So the rest of the paper, what we do is to test this hypothesis, unfortunately with municipal data. And I will explain to the end why I say unfortunately only with municipal data. We have a cross-section of over 2,000 municipalities, 1 year, 2013. Our data on vigilantes is a 1-0. So when they're in a municipality, there is a vigilante group or not, and we take this data from Philips. Not many vigilante groups overall, but still they were present in 13 of the 32 states in Mexico, 31 plus the Mexico City, okay? And then we also gathered data, mostly from the census, on the percentage of households receiving remittances at the municipal level. The average amount of remittances is 6.5% of households in a municipality receiving remittances, all right? And we controlled for many, many other variables. Who in here is a quant person? Just to see how fast I go over this. We can go over in the Q&A if you want to about the details of the estimation, so on and so forth. Just to give you an idea of some things we are controlling for, apart from remittances as a percentage of households in the municipality, we have the rate of immigration, population, GDP per capita. The Gini is very important in this story because if you remember, one of the main determinants of vigilante groups is inequality at the municipal level. Schooling rates, the homicide rate, of course, because that's the reason why these groups emerge, right? What kind of political party we have in the municipality, whether it is the party of the presidency or an opposition party, and also the number of migrant associations, hometown associations, a measure of international connectivity at the state level, okay? Big problem, before moving to the big problem. There you have where vigilante groups are, okay? High concentration in two states. Is anyone familiar with Mexico? Which states are those?
Is that Sonora?
Yeah.
Up there,
and
yeah.
And then Chihuahua?
Yes, and then in this coast?
Michoacán?
Michoacán, no. Yes. No. And Guerrero. Guerrero and Michoacán, okay? And it is not by chance that we have, well, it's first areas are very badly hit by crime, right? But also these areas down there have been always areas in which there has been grassroots mobilization, okay? Precedents, historical precedents of them. And this is a map. The municipal level as well, measuring remittances. The darkest areas are the areas of where inflows are largest. And those of you familiar with migration in Mexico, this is also very predictable, okay? This accords very much with the states that are the highest, the most immigrant intensive and with higher levels of migration intensity, which is mostly in the center and the south. Now, very quickly, just for the people here, of course, in estimating the impact of remittances on whatever, the problem is that we are very likely to observe the reverse effect is equally plausible. And we are at the LSE and knowing the consequences of things and stuff like that. So we really want to define that the relationship that we are finding here is a relationship from remittances to crime. Why? Because it could be as well that if we have crime on the other side as the explanatory variable, And remittances as the determinant, as the outcome variable, as the dependent variable, we can very well think that that context of vigilantes and the violence that they sometimes breed and create can be a determinant as well of the amount of remittances flowing in. So this sort of reverse causality is always a headache. And we are dealing with an IV strategy, an international instrumental variable strategy, using instrumental variables that have been used before at the municipal level in research. Okay, happy to share all this information and the database and whatever you need. Okay, I'm going to go directly to the interpretation. So, in terms of what we expect, or the way we model this non-linear relationship between remittances and the probability of observing vigilantes, is by using remittances in a quadratic, introducing a quadratic term. So we have remittances and then square remittances, and expecting here a positive sign for remittances and a negative sign for the squared of remittances, which we find, okay? After controlling for all these other things, we still have a positive effect of remittances on the probability of observing vigilante groups in the linear term, and in the quadratic term what we have is a negative one. So this is a curvilinear effect, an inverted U-shape kind of effect. This probably says nothing to you in terms of substantive effects, so some substantive reading of those results. In general, the probability, what we observe is the probability of engagement, or the probability of observing vigilantes is low, just 1.6% for municipalities in the 25th percentile of the distribution of municipalities. Okay? I'm going to be giving more examples. That probability increases to 9.4%. Probability of observing vigilante groups in municipalities in the 75th percentile, which is roughly 9% of remittance recipients' households in the municipality. So let me explain this. If you recall, on average, the average for the whole of Mexico is around 6.5% of households in a municipality receiving remittances. Okay? When we observe municipalities in which 9% of the households, not 6 but 9, a little bit more than the average, receive remittances, the probability of observing vigilante groups actually jumps quite considerably in comparison to the 25th percentile. But then what we observe is that for municipalities in the 95th percentile, the probability goes down a little bit, or the rate in which the probability increases, in reality increases a little bit, is lower. Anyway, importantly, I think, municipalities where high remittance penetration lowers the probability of vigilantism are those above the 25th percentile, okay? If we plotted a curve, we would observe the inverted U-shapes and an inflection point around 15% of remittance recipient households. So in reality, it takes a very sizable amount of households receiving remittances to slow down the rate of the probability of observing vigilantes. Am I making myself clear? Mm-hmm. Or in other words, in a majority of remittance recipient municipalities, what we observe is sort of an activation effect. Low probability, right? Then it jumps considerably, slows down, but that slows down happens only in municipalities with considerably high rates of households receiving remittances, all right? Okay, there were many municipalities with no vigilantes at all, and that's the reason why we ran Tobit regression as well. The results are robust, and then the IV approach, and the results are robust. Very quickly, because probably I didn't ask about how much time I have.
Five minutes.
One of the things that I want to comment, of course, you probably are thinking, well, maybe this is just a story about Mexico, maybe this is just a story about vigilantism. So we produced another paper looking at a different instance of collective mobilization against crime. And in particular, we looked at non-violent mobilization events, okay? Organized by citizens, marches, demonstrations, road blockages, community meetings with authorities, labor strikes, collective public prayers, sit-ins, collective press conferences. These were collected by one of our co-authors, Sandra, Sandra Lay, and using newspapers, okay? About 50 Mexican newspapers. And this database accounts for over 1,000 of these events. That, unlike vigilantism, these ones are non-violent, okay? And, well, what we were hypothesizing is, or trying to see, is whether that sort of inverted U-shape occurred as well when it came to explaining non-violent mobilization against crime, right? Whether these remittances activated non-violent protest, but then after a certain amount, they had this sort of disengagement effect due to, we argue, due to substitution mechanisms and due to lower grievances. And this is what we have in terms of the protests. Again, quite easy to predict where the concentration of protests took place is north. And again, we have Michoacán there, and Veracruz, also high one, and the border states. And these are remittances at the state level, okay? At the state level. We were using data here at the quarterly level and at the state level. Number of protests, the data that I just described, again, remittances, all those controls, migration population, schooling, percentage of indigenous population, what kind of parties empower the homicide rate, and some measures of local connectivity. We are interested in the international connectivity and use remittances as one of those international connections, right? But then we were controlling as well for local connectivity, churches, civil associations, unions, and finally the state wealth, okay? And this is what we find when it comes to predicting the count of remittances. Oh, sorry, the count of protests, okay? We observe that inverted U-shape that we found before in the case of vigilantism. With one difference here, and the difference is that the tipping point in the case of nonviolent protest, the tipping point happens earlier, let's say, in the distribution of remittances, okay? So while it took many households in a municipality receiving remittances to discourage or lower the probability of observing vigilantes, the amount of remittances that is enough to produce disengagement when it comes to nonviolent protest is lower, all right? And we think that has to do with the fact that these are two very different technologies of protesting. One of them is relatively cheap, which is just, you know, a sit-in, a march, right? Vigilantes require more resources, more personal commitment, more financial commitment as well. Many of these vigilante organizations are armed, for instance, okay? So in summary, those anecdotes that led us to research, to do this research, these anecdotes that we were finding in newspaper reports, in journalistic articles, those are not anecdotes, it appears, okay? Migrants involvement in the vigilante movement in Mexico is not anecdotal. And when we test this against data, we observe that the result, the hypothesis is backed up by data. Okay, transnational connections matter in domestic collective mobilization, and probably this is not surprising to you. But the fact is that when it comes to those international factors explaining protest, it is not that we have a lot of evidence out there. Okay. Remittances cause political engagement and disengagement, and what we think is that these effects are not exclusive, but simply are predominant at different levels of remittances. In short, receiving remittances increases the resources available for protesting, but also reduces the reasons or incentives to do so. All right? At very high percentages of remittance recipient households, controlling for other factors, collective mobilization is less likely. Yet in a majority of Mexican municipalities, remittances do predict the existence of self-defense organizations, and we happen to find exactly the same kind of effect when we study non-violent protest. Things for which we would like to have feedback on or discuss with you, for instance. I think that I should say that in terms of the normative implications of this study, we are quite agnostic in the sense that it is very well known that sometimes these vigilante groups have been co-opted by crime themselves. And so we are not making a reading of, oh, how lovely migrants sending remittances, helping their relatives to protect themselves. Well, that's one part of the story, but there is this other side to the story of these vigilante groups in municipalities being the cause of crime and greater homicide rates, so on and so forth. Sometimes because they collude with migrant with drug organizations. Okay. Of course, we would like to know whether this kind of finding travels beyond Mexico, and there are many other countries in which this could make sense. Testing the relevance of remittances in funding collective mobilization against crime. We have a major problem that we want to discuss with you as well, and it is that, as you see, we have been using municipal data and state-level data, but the mechanisms that we are proposing that are behind what is going on are mostly individual. So we really would have liked to test this using individual-level data. But unfortunately, the surveys that we have out there do not have questions about amount of remittances. Well, some of them, some surveys, of course, have this question about how much remittances, not where there, but what's the amount. But the problem is finding out there surveys in which you have the question about the amount of remittances and then questions about political behavior. Those are very uncommon yet. So just throwing some ideas for some PhD. And some PhDs there, right? And then probably you're wondering, but well, what exactly is going on? I mean, are you guys offering any real test of any of these substitution effects, or the lower grievances, or are you just relying on secondary literature on that? Or more specifically, probably one interesting question is, what is happening there from an individual receiving remittances to observing municipal or state effects? No? How these remittances, the effects scale up at the municipal level and at the state level? So those are some questions that we haven't resolved, and probably many others. So thank you very much for
thank
your...
You fascinating data. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ryan, you're gathering your thoughts, and also because I'm very keen to ask this question, so I get started with just, I'm very curious about the indirect effects of remittances. So remittances have been shown to increase relative deprivation. So I'm wondering what happens, whether those who are not getting the remittances, whether it increases protests among those who are not getting them, because the others are getting them, so there's a higher sense of disadvantage among those who are not getting them. Have you, I mean, that's probably very difficult to assess quantitatively.
That, I mean, that's a very interesting question, but the thing is that, I mean, those not, what kind of resources those not receiving remittances have to protest?
So it could increase the protest of the vigilante.
It could,
so
yeah, exactly. Yeah. It could probably, I would say, maybe increase the sort of non-violent, less expensive kind
yes.
of technology. But I mean, I think you're right, and that's the reason why we were so concerned about having a control on inequality there, because it is known that remittances may impact inequality and actually exacerbating inequality and creating this division between. I was once in a conference on Africa and remittances, and someone said that remittance recipients have become the new divide between the haves and the have-nots in Africa is those that receive remittances versus those that don't receive remittances, right? From our point of view, because this is a very resource sort of driven paper, the question was not so much about those that don't receive remittances anymore, because what we wanted to see explicitly is what happens to those that receive remittances, but maybe different at a different scale. Yeah, it's a very good question. Yeah.
Just a quick question. Are you looking at remittances from like migrants who move internationally, or also just who go to urban areas?
Only internationally.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it would be the same trend just from people who move from rural areas to urban areas within Mexico?
That's a very interesting question, and one that we have been considering as well. The thing is that we cannot find, I believe there are no data on remittances, on internal remittances at the census level.
Mm.
There is information on internal migration, but not on internal remittances, as far as I know. At least in the data, in the census data that we have been using, we didn't find data on. That's an interesting question and something that deserves some thought. In principle, I don't see why the effects would be different between internal and international remittances.
Yeah.
Really.
Mm.
Why?
Yeah,
I mean, maybe we can
right.
think together on this, no? But I don't see any reason why the effects would be different. I mean, there are other issues here that definitely need field work and talking to people, which we haven't done in this regard. Which is, we don't know whether this is a relative's decision to send money, earmarking the money, and telling their relatives, you guys use this to buy a gun, right? Or whether this is a decision that recipients make independently of what the relatives, they just get the money and decide to devote the remittances to contribute to this sort of organization. We have no idea about this. Again, this is all very anecdotal, the kind of more subtle mechanisms that definitely we need to provide in order to be more persuasive, I think. But that's a very interesting question, something to think about. What do you think, Eduardo?
Yeah, no, I was thinking about the urban-rural migration. I think, in terms of volume, it's probably definitely lower than the international. And also I think about the dynamics of it. I think when people migrate from the countryside to the city, either they take their kids
mm-hmm.
with them, or so it's a more like family migration
mm-hmm.
as well.
Yeah.
I don't know, but it's definitely, I think, worth exploring in the sense that...
But that's very interesting, right? Because, yeah, if it is more like the whole family moving, the reasons to remit... Probably that's the reason why it hasn't been mentioned in the literature, plus the data problem, I would say. Yeah.
And also the differences in wage,
exactly.
Wages are much less,
definitely.
So you can't send as much.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. There was another question.
So I had two questions. The first one's kind of already been answered, but I had a question whether there was any kind of interaction between those who are sending remittances and the actual decision to use the remittances to take up vigilante work, as well as whether it affects sort of where they're sending their remittances from, so what country they're based in that they're making the capital and then sending that back, whether there's any correlation between that and the sort of vigilante levels that we're seeing in different parts of Mexico.
But the thing is that we have, in terms of destinations,
mm-hmm.
you mean, whether
mm-hmm.
the destination country matters.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of Mexico, we don't have much variation
mm-hmm.
there, because 95% of the
mm-hmm.
immigration goes to the United States and the other one goes to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
What I have found there is that Mexico, it's somehow a most likely case, because there is a culture along the border of patrols and armies, and that sort of is a good area, no? Like that border specifically is like a really a good field for that sort of movement to emerge, no? That sort of vigilante organizations. It would be terrific if we could have a comparative study with countries in which we know that vigilantes. And there are many countries, no, in which vigilantes have emerged, and with different destinations, right? And to come up with some sort of theory about whether variation in destinations, for instance, whether destinations are more or less autocratic or democratic, things like that. That sort of variation in destination is something that we are exploiting in other papers, and looking at other political outcomes such as democratization and things like that, whether the diasporas are based in other autocratic countries versus other democratic countries, things like that. But in the case of vigilantes, I guess that the main problem is getting comparative data on vigilante organizations.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a very good point.
Mike has a question, and then you can maybe ask him.
Thank you, that's very interesting. I don't know much about remittances, so I'm just wondering, it's a descriptive question, really. I'm interested in, is there a normal pattern in terms of which family member does the moving to the country? Is it usually husbands or kids?
In Mexico, it is male migration.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's the sons of families in remittances, or I'm kind of wondering if it makes a difference who the family member is. Who.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. But again, with our, I think that at some point, didn't we control for the percentage of females in the household? But that's something that we could do. Maybe in another paper. This is the three paper series thing that gets us a little bit confused. But that's something that we maybe could be controlling for, whether it makes a difference whether easily at the municipal level.
Mm.
No, I mean, those municipalities in which there is a high percentage of female, let's say, driven, no, female-headed households, are those more likely to have vigilante groups? My hunch is that it is not, but maybe I'm here being very predictable in my hunch.
Because who are the vigilante group? Like, who is the people that? Because from what I know, like, you don't see women in this vigilante group.
Well, you see women.
Yeah, but mostly it's like young, well, from what I know,
males.
It's like the niece, nephews and like cousins or like...
That's such a good thing that we should add to the paper, no, a little bit more about the demographics of these groups. No? But definitely there have been females involved.
Yeah,
so I don't know, maybe I should be revising my hunch about.
We've got
one
last question.
So the other question I had was, is if you're aware of any sort of pattern in which the remittances for vigilantism is used based off a collective decision to use those remittances for that, or if it's all just individualized, and whether this kind of compares with other strategies that people use remittances for?
That's a great question. For that, you need to do field work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And do you feel work in this kind of context is something that you have to do carefully? But it is doable. I mean, our colleague Sandra Lay gathered her data on non-violent protest through joining these marches, and we have other colleagues back in Mexico that are doing research, and here as well. We have Jenny Pierce and Isabella Bello that have been doing research on qualitative research on these sort of dynamics. So that's definitely something that we need. That's the kind of meat that the paper, this research is missing, I think. Which you know, this is linked to what I was saying towards the end about getting your feedback, no, about the mechanisms by which these individual remittances scale up to something that is collective. Is this a collective decision? And if it is a collective decision, how does this happen? Or whether it is just like, you know, individual decisions. That's I think is crucial for the book, maybe.
Brilliant, thank you so much.
No, thank you so much.
Absolutely fascinating. Thank you all for coming. 14th of November is the next date. I hope to see you again then.
Thanks for organizing this. Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you so much.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you.